Good morning, Brian.
Again, good morning.
Thank you. Nice to talk to you, too. The first things first, the cap they announced yesterday is climbing up to $80 million. Is this a good thing for the NHL or not?
Well, I wasn't at the meeting, obviously. I don't get to go to those meetings anymore. I'm not sure yet if it's that one side or the other triggered the escalator or if it's just normal revenue growth. If it's just normal revenue growth, yes, it's a good thing. And the league warned us repeatedly through the year that 80 would be the least it would be. It would go up to possibly even higher than that. So, yeah, that kind of growth is a good thing. I think people don't understand, and maybe I can take 30 seconds and explain it really crudely. The key to the whole thing working is that the players have accepted a cap, but the owners, in order to get that cap to work, do a massive revenue sharing plan so that the really successful teams are subsidizing the weaker teams to the tune of $25 million U.S. is the most you can receive. But a team like an Arizona team or a Florida team said they lost $30 million. 25 of that could be covered by revenue sharing. So that's what makes the whole thing work. So, yes, player salaries will go up, but the smaller markets are given the tools and the means to compete.
Brian, today in Dallas, where you are, is it about possibly finalizing talks that you might have had with teams before the draft as to deals that could be made? Or could something just spring out of nowhere in the next 24 or 36 hours? What's the likelihood of something coming out of nowhere, or the conversations maybe coming to a close of what you've been working on for a while?
Well, I made two big deals at the draft, as you guys know, and I don't want to spend a lot of time on them because they're so long ago now, but they both happened on the floor. But all the work that was done that went into it, you know, like you go back to the Chris Pronger deal in 1993, we knew that San Jose wanted Sergei Makarov. We went and got him weeks before this because we knew that that was going to be a key part of our pitch. So, you know, the deal with the Sedins to get the fourth pick in the draft, that happened. That deal actually happened on Father's Day, the Sunday before the draft. We just didn't register it until the Friday before the draft. So you can have stuff happen suddenly. You know, over the years, a couple times I've had to react to something in 2 or 3 minutes. But in general, my view is if you've got to make the decision in 2 or 3 minutes, your odds of making a good decision are very poor. What's more likely is all these teams have talked about all these different scenarios. What makes this draft intriguing is the number of teams with multiple first-round picks. It's unprecedented.
How often do those 2 or 3 minute offers come out? I mean, is that just almost a team trying to panic you in a panic move? Is that a tactic sometimes, or how often does that scenario present itself? Where, I mean, we play armchair quarterbacks watching from a TV or you know, watching from a distance, going, oh man, they're on the clock. Are they going to make a move here? I mean, we see it from an NFL draft standpoint, but they've got a little more breathing room before that pick. But what? How often is that scenario where that all of a sudden there's that you're up against the clock in 2 minutes to make a deal?
It's very rare, but when it's happened to me, it's only once or twice. When it has happened, it's been based on a name that's called. So a team, say, I don't know if you remember, it was televised because I was mic'd up. We took Nazem Kadri, I believe, at 7, and Brian Murray walked up to me as I was getting up and said, we'll trade the pick to you, that moved down one. And we had that discussion. We said, depending on who's there, because we really wanted to take Nazem Kadri. I said, depending on who's there, we might make the deal. He walked up and said, you want to make the deal? I said, who are you taking? He said, Kadri. I said, no, we're taking him, and walked up and took him. So it happened that quickly, but it's usually a name is called. So you're the GM of the Vancouver Canucks, and you really want Joe Schwartz, and you think he's going at 7 or at 6, and you've got the 7th pick. Joe Schwartz goes at 6. Now someone who behind you who knows that's the guy you wanted comes up and says, okay, do you want to move down now? The guy you wanted just went off the board. Do you want to move down now? And you'll see a guy take a timeout sometimes. So it does happen. It's rare, and it's in response to a name that's called.
Players always love when it's a game 7. They'll tell the media this is what it's all about, all the pressure. Are draft days the game 7 every year for the GMs?
Especially for the teams in the front row, like your goal is to get out of the front row. Like it's so embarrassing, and I sat there plenty of times. Trust me, when you're in the 5 or 6 worst teams and you're in the front row, That's the humiliating part. And you can't get out of there fast enough. You're on TV more than the other teams, and it's really embarrassing. But it is the payoff. This is one you get rewarded for, the tears that you shed the year before, the tears that your fans shed the year before. And this is when your fortunes start to be reversed. So it's a special day. I thought it was always a cool day. I mean, the coolest draft I went to was in 07 after we won the Cup. So you're in that back right corner. Only one team gets to sit in the back right corner, man, and that's the Champions. And that's the best draft I ever had, despite the Twins and Pronger and all the rest of it, was sitting in that back seat saying, this is pretty cool.
Would it not make sense to have the awards and the draft in the same city?
Yes. I've said this before. I think a team that bids for the draft, like the Canucks, have the draft next year, I believe, correct?
Yeah.
So they should have been required to submit as part of that an awards proposal and say, okay, we've got this venue, use one of the beautiful new casinos, or I hear they're beautiful, I haven't been in them. There's one, right? Isn't there a nice
one? Yeah, they're a nice one, the Park Casino.
Yeah,
that's a nice free plug for them. They'll appreciate that right by the rink.
Well, I didn't name it. I don't know.
I did. I'm looking for myself, not you.
Oh, okay, good. I'm not much of a gambler, but I heard it's beautiful. So you say, okay, we're going to apply for the draft. We're also going to do, in my mind, always the awards. And then the league will continue to grow this. You'll have street fairs and, like the league does a really good job about growing events, and they'll grow the draft. They already have. But I think the host city should also have to bid on the awards.
Brian Burke with us here on Sportsnet 650. How dangerous is it to go off the grid, off conventional wisdom, when you're drafting by need as opposed to the best player available? Which approach do you like the best?
Well, you are talking about massive risk if you draft by position. Massive risk. Because you're passing on a player your scouts have told you is better. You're passing on at least one or two or three or four players your scouts have told you are better players than the player you're taking. And you're saying, no, but I need a defenseman, so I'm taking a defenseman. Our rule was real simple. You never draft by position, ever, ever, ever. And we never changed the list on the floor. Once the list is done, it's done. And a scout can't come to me and say, hey, Perry Salkowski's available. We didn't think he'd be there. And nope, we're going by the list. If we've got names ahead of his, that's fine. We're taking whoever's on that list when it's our turn, we're taking that name.
Does that happen? Where somebody all of a sudden has like the cold feet?
It happened with Corey Snyder. I was doing TV for the draft that year, and I knew Vancouver's list, and they got to Corey Snyder, and they ground to a halt. Remember, they took a timeout. And they went off the list and picked Corey Snyder. Pretty good move. You know, that's one where whoever, whether the chief scout or whether that was, I don't know which went to Dave Nonis and said, you got to stop it, or Mike Gillis, I'm not even sure who the GM was.
It was Dave.
They went off the list, froze the draft, and I'm doing this on TV, and I'm going, wait a second, they just announced Corey Snyder. I know their list. I have their list. Corey Snyder was not the next name on the list. Pretty good pick. But that's the risk. If Corey Snyder is a bust, you got a big problem because there were players taken after him that turned into good players.
Do you have, and I guess we don't want to be specific with names, and I'm sure you're in the business so long. Do you have a couple of drafts? For example, Peter Chiarelli getting ripped by Edmonton fans on social media going, geez, you could have had Barzell. You never drafted him. Taylor Hall walks up and gets the heart. You moved him for Adam Larson. Easy fodder for fans on social media to go, you made mistakes at the time when those trades are made and the draft takes place. You don't know what you could have. Is there a couple through your time in the NHL and your positions where you said, geez, how did I miss that one?
Well, you go back in Vancouver, there was two or three drafts in a row where I don't think I picked a player that played. Now, that's not good. That's, to me, if you're going to go on TV and talk like an expert, you better acknowledge your mistakes. I think there were two drafts in a row there where the Smith draft, where we drafted the Smith kid in the first round, and then Jason Herter, his draft way back with Pat, I think only one guy played. But I think I had two drafts in a row where no one played out of the six or seven or eight guys we picked. And then the next year was Kessler, and obviously that was a good hit. That was a great pick at 20, I think he was, or 17, whatever it was. So, yeah, I made lots of mistakes. And Barzal, everyone knew about Barzal. And this, by the way, I'd love to have some of these people's jobs where they spend 2 hours a night on the internet and do all their analytics and then rip GMs for not making good picks. We're drafting 18-year-olds. All right, this is not the NFL. We're drafting 22 and 23-year-olds. We're drafting 18-year-olds. It's so unpredictable what they're going to do. And the success rate in the first round, the success rate is only 64, 65%. In the second round, it drops to less than 25. So this is not easy. This is not a science. This is really, we do all the scientific work we can, but at the end of the day, you're kind of grabbing your groin and pulling hard and hoping you get it right. So, I mean, it's that simple. We're going to make lots of mistakes. We do. The Monday morning quarterbacking, that comes with the job, and thank God people care enough to do it. But, boy, is that simple to do. Wait 2 years or wait a year and say, hey, look at Barzal. Like, we liked Barzal. We had players rated ahead of him. He hit the gap on us. So you pick wherever you pick, and then you don't pick again for 31 picks, and players hit the gap on you. So a lot of guys you like, you never get a shot at them.
I had someone who was down at the combine.
Nice image, by the way.
Tell me. Yeah, I know. He's painting a picture. That's radio, Brian. You do it very well.
Pulling the groin. There you go.
Someone at the combine this year told me he's never seen a group in the last 6 or 7 years that is – and he didn't use the word cocky, just said kids are just much more confident now. They're not going to give you the standard answer to, you know, I hope to one day help the team. They go, no, I think I can help immediately. Have you seen a change in the personality of kids who get drafted just to show that much more confidence? Not disrespect, Brian, but, you know, I can help you and I can help you now.
Well, I interviewed a bunch of kids at the Combine for Sportsnet. I didn't see that. Actually, I was impressed with the number of kids that said, I know I need more time. I know I'm not ready, but a couple guys, yeah, they were like, yeah, my goal is to make the team this year. There's always been in the top 6 or 7 guys. Guys have always said that. It's my goal is to stick next year. The fact is very few guys stick, and some of the ones who stick shouldn't stick. They stick because teams want to use them as a marketing tool and say, look, we're smart. We drafted a kid who made our team as an 18-year-old, when in fact it costs you a lot of money to keep him that extra year. You bring him up as an 18-year-old, he gets arb rights a year early. He gets free agency a year early. It costs you a lot of money to do that. But now they can turn to their season ticket base and say, hey, Joe Schwartz made our team as an 18-year-old. Our scouts know what they're doing. So I have always sent my guys back. I'll tell you, I don't know how much time we have. Can I tell you a short story?
It can be a long story.
Yeah.
So Matthew Tkachuk, we went to ownership and said 2 years ago, he's going back to London. And then Ken King was my boss, and told Ken that. And then he played his last preseason game, and he just excelled. He just showed all those things that, you know, that he does, this aggravating, skilled guy. And so Tree, our GM, Brad Sullivan, came to me and said, I want to keep him. And I called Ken and said, I want to keep him. And he's like, well, you already told the owners that he's going back. I said, I don't. And Ken is a good guy. And Ken went to bat with the owners and said, look, we're keeping him. Oh, good decision. But he earned his keep, right, as a player. But I think we keep a lot of guys that don't earn their keep as players. And this is a case where, you know, thanks to my boss, and again, I don't work there anymore, so I don't have to kiss Ken's butt, but thanks to Ken, I think we made a very informed, and the owners backed him up on it, obviously. We made a very informed decision and a right one. But in general, I've always sent him back. You know, I sent Bobby Ryan back. I sent everyone back. I sent Kadri back.
Brian Burke with us here on Sportsnet 650. One of the names that are kind of floating around right now as a potential trade consideration, whether you want to buy into it or not, is Artemi Panarin, who is apparently telling the Jackets he doesn't want to talk an extension right now. He's 26. He's got 1 year left in his deal. I guess a two-part question here. One, how do you approach this from a GM's perspective in Columbus? And secondly, you know, what would it something like that take for here's a guy who's young enough that I think if you're Vancouver, and the sense is that Jim Benning's looking at all different shapes and sizes and areas right now to try to make a move or try to do something to help make this team better. What would something like that cost even here in Vancouver?
Well, I think you'd have to take him only if you had permission to talk to his agent first. Yeah. I don't think the price tag to get a player of that value unsigned is very different than the price tag to get a player of that value signed. And in my mind, you know, if you're in that position, first thing you do is you ask for permission to talk to the player's agent and get some sense. And my guess is that Jarmo Kekäläinen and the GM in Columbus at this point would not grant that permission. He'd say, no, of course we're not going to give you permission now. We're going to continue to meet with him, find out what he wants. Now, as of yesterday, they know the cap at least. So now you go back to the agent and say, okay, now we know what the cap is at least. Do you want to sit down? If he says, no, we want to wait, then you got to go in and sit down with the agent and say, okay, what's the plan here? You want to wait? Why? Are you going to sit down with me at some point? Do you want to wait till the season begins? Do you have a timeline here? And if he says, no, we're just going to wait and play it out, we want to become unrestricted, then, yeah, it's time to start moving them.
Our colleague John Shannon said he thinks there's a couple teams that are reaching out to Barry Trotz. What's your sense as to what he would do and how he handled the whole situation? Boy, you know, we heard the term, and certainly when you were here, you know, the lame duck GM or coach when they don't have that contract. Barry Trotz rolled the dice and you know, probably made his mind up a long time ago and now sits in a perfect position. What do you think goes on with him? Or do you think I have the feeling he waits to see if Seattle's there and then can take a little bit of a rest?
Well, these guys make enough money now that they don't have to go right back to work. And, you know, that's a good thing. I'm not saying that negatively. I don't know Barry well. I know him to speak to, and I like him, and I respect him as a coach. I thought he let the contract status affect him a little bit early in the playoffs. He openly talked about it and said winning doesn't define who I am or what I am. Talked about the impact of being a lame duck. And I thought early on in the Columbus series it was troubling him. And then he managed to put it behind him and went on this magical run and did a great job. I mean, they deserve the cup. They were fantastic. So I think he can write his own ticket. I don't think he can right now because there aren't that many vacancies. Now, you remember in 1990, so I came back to Vancouver in 98. At the end of the 98-99 season, Glenn Sather left Edmonton. And we all had contracts, right? But this is like Jaws. There's a great white shark off the beach. And you know, even if you have a contract, you're at risk now. Because this is a giant. This is a guy that they'll call you in and say, hey, when we gave you that contract, we didn't know we'd get Glenn Sather, so see ya. And that's what's happening now. There are teams looking saying, okay, we like our coach, but Barry Trotz wasn't available when we signed our coach. Should we look at making a change? So there's actually some discussion in my mind. I don't know. I haven't talked to anyone who's having this discussion.
Mm-hmm.
In my mind, if I'm a GM, I go to my owner and say, we at least got to talk about this guy. I know we have a coach, but we have to at least talk about this guy. That's the scary part is it's not what's vacant. It's who might get hoofed out of a chair to create a spot for it. My prediction is he'll take some time here and sort it out.
One more before we let you go. Brian Burke joining us on the starting lineup. Selkowski, Cebulski. Watching last night, Brian, and I know you've always been about team and community and being involved. As we watched, you know, the kids from the Florida high school come up, as we saw Derek England and you know, what went on in Las Vegas and then, of course, Humboldt. Can you ever remember a year where the NHL has become so much of the community and how well they handled all situations and used their platform to try and to help people out and affect change?
I couldn't be prouder of the National Hockey League than I was this year, but I hope I never see that again. I hope we never have the opportunity to be that magnanimous. It was a horrible year. The last calendar year was, or last season and right before in Las Vegas is full of bad news. And this has got to stop. And, so in my mind, I hope we never get a chance to shine like we did last night. But, yeah, we shone pretty good last night. That was fun to watch. And I got to meet a couple of the Humboldt kids that lived in Calgary or around Calgary. And these kids are just amazing. So, yeah, it was fun to watch and really fun to watch the Twins. I missed it. I flew here last night, and the flight was 2 hours late. And I knew, I'm like, I'm going to miss the award. So I saw the tail end of it. I saw the Humboldt kids. I saw the Florida kids. I missed Danny and Hank, so I haven't even sent them a note this morning, but I'm so proud of them, too.